Imagine being, the most technologically advanced, heavily armed superpower in your entire region,
Right.
but you feel so existentially vulnerable that your only diplomatic tool is basically a sledgehammer.
Yeah, it's a wild concept.
It really is. Today, we are looking at this huge paradox, a nation that might actually be trapped by its own overwhelming strength.
Exactly, because we're examining a state that built this unparalleled military machine to guarantee its survival. But now they're finding that constantly wielding that machine might actually be dismantling their society from the inside out.
Yeah, and we are looking at this through the eyes of a veteran journalist who lives right in the center of all this, a man who has become, honestly, almost totally isolated in his own country just for pointing this paradox out.
It's a really fascinating inversion of how we typically understand national security. I mean, the conventional assumption is that an overwhelming military advantage will eventually force, a political resolution.
Right, or at least stable deterrence.
Exactly. But the reality described in our source material suggests the exact opposite.
That the overwhelming strength can become a psychological prison.
Yeah, blinding a society to any solution that doesn't involve absolute force.
So, we're going to explore all of the mechanisms behind that idea in today's deep dive. We are unpacking this dense, highly revealing transcript from a recent broadcast on Tucker Carlson's YouTube channel.
Right, it features a long-form interview with Gideon Levy, who is a veteran, highly controversial Israeli journalist.
Yes, and our mission today is to break down Levy's deeply critical perspective on his country's current conflicts. We're looking at the historical context of the region and the massive geopolitical implications of United States support.
And we're also going to examine what the broadcast's own embedded ad reads tell us.
Oh, yeah, the ads are incredibly specific. We'll
They
get
are.
into what they tell us about the American audience absorbing this message right now.
Because the intersection between that geopolitical critique and the specific demographic targeted by those ads, it reveals a massive shifting tectonic plate in American foreign policy.
It really does. We are going to get deep into that shifting landscape. But before we get into the weeds of this, I need to pause for a moment and speak directly to you, the listener.
Very important point here.
Yeah. Because the sources we are exploring today contain highly charged political content touching on both left-wing and right-wing viewpoints, it is crucial to establish that we, your guides, are taking no sides.
None at all.
We are not endorsing the viewpoints, policies, or moral judgments presented in the source material. Our sole objective is to impartially report and analyze the ideas, claims, and context contained in the original text so you can understand the full picture.
Right. And to understand that picture, we really have to start with the visceral daily reality inside Israel, as Levy describes it.
Right.
He paints this picture of a society trapped in a state of perpetual whiplash. I mean, he describes the current existence for citizens in Tel Aviv as an absolute roller coaster.
Yeah, where you can go to sleep at night with the promise of a ceasefire.
Right, and then wake up in the morning to the sound of sirens and ballistic missiles flying overhead.
Which is, I mean, a society cannot exist in that state of neurological hyperarousal indefinitely without it fundamentally altering their worldview.
No, of course not.
Levy argues this perpetual whiplash isn't just an unfortunate byproduct of a specific military campaign either. He makes this sweeping claim that Israel is currently fighting aimless wars of choice.
Across multiple fronts,
Right.
right?
In Gaza, in Lebanon, with Iran. And his core critique is that these wars lack any concrete endgame.
Right. He repeatedly asks, what is the point if there are no clearly defined political goals beyond just the act of fighting itself?
So, what is the mechanism driving that aimlessness?
Well, it's deeply psychological. Levy traces this back to a foundational mindset that he says has taken hold of the nation. He describes Israel's self-perception as a villa in the jungle.
A villa in the jungle.
Yeah, and we need to analyze the immense weight of that phrase. If you define yourself as a villa, you inherently view your society as civilized, cultured, enlightened. But by defining everyone around you as the jungle, you are making this fatalistic declaration that your neighbors are wild, untamed, and fundamentally irrational.
Okay, let's unpack this. It's like a mechanic who only owns a sledgehammer. Suddenly, every single geopolitical problem looks like something that just needs to be smashed.
Yeah, exactly.
It completely blinds them to the idea of using a wrench. When you convince yourself you are dealing with a jungle, you inherently reject the vocabulary of diplomacy or compromise.
Because you believe a jungle only respects raw force.
Right.
And to take your analogy further, It is as if that sledgehammer is being endlessly paid for by a wealthy uncle.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So the mechanic never even feels the financial pressure to learn how to use a wrench.
That's a great point. And Levy points out a staggering statistic to illustrate how deeply this mentality permeates the culture. He notes that in the initial days of the recent conflict, 93% of Israelis supported an aggressive war with Iran.
93%?
Yeah. He actually compares that figure to the kind of unified polling you only see in totalitarian regimes like North Korea.
Which is wild to think about.
He does clarify that the number has trended lower since then, perhaps settling closer to 80%. But the initial, almost reflexive societal unity around launching a massive new war is what he finds so alarming.
The societal implication of that reflex is chilling. I mean, Levy argues that launching a new war will always be more popular in the Israeli mindset than signing a peace agreement.
Always.
Yeah. If leaders attempted to finalize a peace agreement with Lebanon today, Levy speculates they wouldn't get anywhere near 93% support. They might struggle to even get 39%.
Because a society conditioned to view itself as the villa sees compromise as an existential threat to its walls.
Exactly. Whereas fighting feels like a necessary, heroic defense of civilization.
And that reliance on military superiority creates an endless feedback loop. I mean, Levy admits that Israel is a regional military superpower equipped with the best technology and endless ammunition.
Right. They could defeat any neighboring force in a conventional battle.
But he argues this overwhelming strength actually corrupts the nation's strategic thinking. It incentivizes leadership to embark on wild military adventures because they know their actual physical survival isn't immediately endangered by a battlefield loss.
Right. As Levy frames it, they win all the wars militarily, but they consistently lose them all politically because they never translate force into stability.
Which is such a massive disconnect.
It is. And that failure to translate force into political stability brings us directly to the physical reality on the ground in Gaza.
Right.
Because this is where Levy shifts from broad psychological critiques to making his most severe, jarring claims of the entire broadcast.
Regarding the actual application of this military power.
Exactly.
But I am struggling to square this, though. If you watch U.S. media, the stated objective of the war in Gaza is incredibly clear.
Sure.
The dismantling of Hamas, which is an internationally recognized terror organization, following the attacks on October 7th. So how does Levy look at that same situation, hear those same stated objectives, and leap to the conclusion that the true goal is the intentional, purposeful destruction of Palestinian civil society? Where is the disconnect between the official narrative and his analysis?
What's fascinating here is that the disconnect lies in what happens the day after a military clears an area.
Okay.
Levy deconstructs the narrative by pointing out who Israel is blocking from stepping into the vacuum. He argues that Israel is not just opposing Hamas.
Right.
They are actively opposing any entity from running civil life in Gaza.
Any entity at all.
Yeah. They reject Hamas, naturally, but they also firmly reject the Palestinian Authority taking over.
Yeah.
And they block the implementation of any organized international force.
So his argument is that by eliminating the current administration, but categorically refusing to let anyone else pick up the trash, run the schools, or police the streets, the engineered result is pure anarchy.
Yes, exactly. Mm. He asks why a local gazan can't simply be a teacher or a judge.
Because allowing a teacher or a judge to operate requires a functional civic infrastructure.
Right. And Levy argues that destroying that infrastructure is the unstated goal.
Wow.
By refusing to let local or international bodies manage civil affairs, he claims the objective is to leave 2 million people living in tents, reducing them to a traumatized, handicapped society incapable of organizing or advocating for statehood.
And the human cost of that statelessness is illustrated in the source with a devastating anecdote. Levy talks about a close personal friend of his, an elderly man who suffered a stroke.
Yeah, this part was rough.
It really was. According to Levy, this man has been lying on the sand in a tent for 2.5 years without access to his basic medication.
Unbelievable.
Levy says he cannot even begin to describe the sheer agony of this man's daily existence.
And the broadcast contrasts that grim reality of stroke victims lying in the sand with the surreal fantasies currently being spun by the international community.
Right, the rebuilding fantasies.
Yeah, the source mentions various international boards and councils holding high-level conferences, drawing up blueprints to rebuild Gaza as an economic hub.
Proposing casinos and luxury resort.
Casinos. And Levy's reaction to those proposals is total cynical dismissal. He recalls being invited years ago to the grand opening of a beautiful new resort hotel in Gaza.
Oh, right.
It was designed for international and Israeli tourists. He attended the launch, and just 2 weeks later, a new war erupted and the entire facility was obliterated.
2 weeks later.
Yeah. He views these modern promises of casinos as dangerous delusions, arguing that pouring concrete is meaningless without a concrete political plan for the people living there.
And the tragedy of this endless cycle is amplified by the source's inclusion of a perspective from Dr. Menard, a British surgeon from Oxford who previously worked in Gaza.
Right. The broadcaster brings up Dr. Menard's assessment of the Gazan people, and Levy emphatically agrees with it.
They discuss the profound courage, the immense resilience, and the surprising sharp sense of humor of the local population.
It's an agonizing juxtaposition. You have a society characterized by resilience and humor being systematically reduced to a stateless, paralyzed condition.
Where people literally lose their lives just waiting in chaotic lines for a single meal.
Exactly. And Levy notes that if he were to publicly express his affection for the people of Gaza while standing in Israel, his peers would look at him as if he were insane.
He actually says they might suggest he be hospitalized.
Right. The fact that expressing basic empathy for a neighboring population is viewed as a symptom of insanity requires us to look backwards.
Yeah.
To understand the mechanics of how a state justifies making a neighboring territory functionally unlivable, we have to examine the historical blueprint that Levy claims is actively being followed.
And he draws a direct, uncompromising line between the military strategies of today and the foundational events of 1948.
Right. He specifically discusses the 1948 Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe.
According to Levy's account in The Source, during this period, over 600,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes. He describes a systematic process where entire villages were destroyed, leaving behind perhaps a few mosques or graves. And then those ruins were literally covered up by the state, planting vast forests and building national parks over them.
The societal mechanics of that cover-up are fascinating and terrifying. I mean, how does a nation collectively suppress a massive historical event within a single generation?
Right. How do you just erase it?
Levy explains that the state literally landscaped over the history. He grew up in Tel Aviv, playing in those very parks, running around those ruins as a child.
Wow.
And he claims he never even heard the word Nakba until he was in his 20s. The educational system and the culture operated in a state of absolute amnesia.
Nobody asked who previously owned the land.
Nope. Or why the original inhabitants were now living in refugee camps a few miles away.
And Levy makes a deeply provocative claim about the cold, pragmatic reality of that amnesia. He says that if you strip away all moral and ethical considerations, the first Nakba worked very well.
He calls it a hell of a success from a strictly demographic standpoint.
Yeah.
And the crucial argument he makes is that the extreme right-wing factions in Israel today, the settlement movement, the dominant political coalitions, they look back at the demographic success of 1948, and they want to replicate it.
They are aiming for a second Nakba in Gaza and eventually in the West Bank.
Exactly. The methodology is to relentlessly push the population south, creating unlivable conditions in the hope that the people eventually just flee the territory entirely.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because it's like trying to treat a chronic illness today by repeating an extreme traumatic surgery from 70 years ago,
right,
completely ignoring the fact that the patient's anatomy and the world watching the operating table has entirely changed.
Yeah, you can't just landscape over a village when everyone has a smartphone.
Exactly. The logistical impossibility of this modern fantasy is staggering. Levy points out the massive, glaring flaw in the extreme right-wing plan. Where exactly are millions of people supposed to go?
Right.
The proponents of this strategy look at the map and suggest pushing Palestinians into the Sinai Desert in Egypt, or perhaps paying off struggling nations like Somalia or Eritrea to absorb millions of refugees.
Which is completely divorced from geopolitical reality.
Mm-hmm.
Egypt has made it abundantly clear they will not absorb 2 million displaced people into the Sinai.
No.
Jordan and Lebanon already absorbed massive refugee populations following the 1948 conflict, and they lack both the capacity and the political will to take in more.
Right. The physical space for mass silent expulsion simply no longer exists. No neighboring country is going to open its borders to millions of stateless individuals.
So we must extrapolate the dark endpoint of this strategy. If the population cannot be pushed into another country, but their current home is intentionally being made unlivable, What is the outcome?
What happens?
Levy offers a grim speculation, comparing the potential fate of the Palestinians to that of Native Americans in the United States. He foresees a future where they are pushed into isolated, forgotten reserves. Stripped of their heritage, deprived of a unified national identity, and essentially erased from the global political agenda.
But a strategy that heavily relies on ignoring logistical reality, alienating neighboring countries, and violating international norms requires a massive external shock absorber.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, a state the size of New Jersey cannot physically manufacture enough localized reality or enough artillery to sustain this kind of isolation without a massive external battery powering the system.
And that external battery is the unconditional military, financial, and political support of the United States.
Right. Yeah.
Levy does not mince words regarding America's role. He calls the United States a full partner in everything that is unfolding.
He argues that Israel's military posture is only sustainable because the U.S. provides the necessary technology, the advanced weaponry,
the endless ammunition,
doing so blindly and without any meaningful boundaries.
But Levy predicts that this unconditional pipeline is operating on a very short timer.
Yeah, this was surprising. During the interview, the broadcaster suggests that U.S. support might slowly wane over the next 5 to 10 years.
And Levy immediately interrupts him and corrects the timeline. He says, we aren't looking at 5 to 10 years. We're looking at 5 to 10 months. He anticipates an imminent seismic shift in U.S. policy.
Because the international pressure is already mounting, Levy points out that European public opinion is overwhelmingly hostile toward Israel's current actions, but European leadership is essentially paralyzed.
Right. They're waiting for a green light from Washington.
The moment the United States alters its stance and removes its unconditional diplomatic cover, Levy believes Europe will instantly translate its public outrage into severe political and economic measures.
And to truly understand why that U.S. shift might be imminent, we have to look closely at the broadcast itself. The source material we are analyzing includes the embedded advertisements that ran during the interview.
Yeah, normally ads are just background noise, but here they serve as a perfect sociological x-ray of the audience absorbing Levy's critique.
This raises an important question, right? The specific demographic being targeted by these sponsors reveals exactly why traditional, unconditioned U.S. foreign aid is suddenly under intense scrutiny from the American right.
So what does this all mean for the listener? Let's break down these three specific sponsors. First, the broadcast cuts to an ad for Joy & Block, a medical clinic offering testosterone and peptide therapy.
Right.
The ad copy speaks directly to men who are dealing with brain fog, who feel they are losing their edge as they age, and who want to regain their vitality.
Okay.
Second, we hear a pitch for Preborn, a domestic charity that sponsors ultrasounds for pregnant women. This ad explicitly calls on expectant fathers to step up, take responsibility, and protect the unborn.
Very targeted.
Yeah. And finally, there's an ad for Stopbox Pro, a company selling quick-access mechanical gun safes that proudly advertise being made entirely in the USA, designed so a father can instantly access his firearm for family self-defense.
We need to analyze the underlying psychology of those ad reads. You have products promising to restore male vitality, charities focused heavily on traditional domestic family structures, and tools designed for aggressive, localized self-reliance.
Right.
This is the very definition of an America First worldview. It is an audience consumed with domestic strength, protecting their immediate families, and rebuilding their own local communities.
And sitting right next to those ads for American-made gun safes and testosterone clinics is a deeply critical, hour-long breakdown of Israeli military policy.
Quite the contrast.
Does this target demographic American men highly focused on self-reliance, traditional values, and domestic security explain why the source's host is suddenly questioning unconditional foreign aid and endless overseas wars?
It really highlights a massive shift. For decades, this exact demographic American men focused on strength and traditional values automatically supported robust foreign intervention and massive foreign aid as a necessary projection of American dominance. But hearing the host of the broadcast explicitly question why America is paying a hell of a price to support a foreign nation that ignores its advice shows the political tectonic plates are fracturing.
The host genuinely views the continuation of unconditioned aid as a mystery, and Levy shares that exact bewilderment. He is astounded by the incredible geopolitical leverage the United States holds, yet categorically refuses to use.
Right. And we should clearly define what that leverage actually looks like in practice. It's not just strongly worded UN resolutions.
Right.
Levy talks about the expansion of settlements in the occupied territories as the prime example. He claims that a sitting U.S. president could halt the entire settlement enterprise with a single phone call.
One phone call.
Because the mechanism of that leverage is entirely financial. Levy explains that the U.S. president simply needs to call and say, if you build one more terrace in the occupied territories, all U.S. aid to Israel stops today. Period.
And he argues that because the Israeli economy and military are so deeply intertwined with U.S. funding, the settlement movement would collapse that very afternoon.
Yet, as Levy points out, no president from either party has ever been willing to make that phone call.
He critiques both sides of the American political aisle on this. He points out that President Obama delivered beautifully crafted, tear-jerking speeches about peace in the Middle East.
Right.
Yet ultimately authorized military aid packages to Israel that were larger and more unconditional than any president before him.
And he notes that Donald Trump simply went along with all of the right-wing's most extreme ideas without applying the brakes.
But the presence of those specific America First advertisements suggests the political appetite for that blank check is rapidly evaporating among conservative voters.
Exactly. And if the U.S. finally applies conditions to its aid, Levy warns that Israel will face an unprecedented challenge, a challenge he considers far more existentially dangerous to the state's survival than the nuclear capabilities of Iran.
Which brings us to an incredible paradox of cognitive dissonance. If the international community is preparing to treat the country as a pariah, European publics are hostile, and the American right wing is finally starting to balk at the financial bill.
Right.
How does the average Israeli citizen justify the ongoing situation to themselves? How do they get up and go to work every day?
The psychological mechanism is both simple and profoundly tragic. They do not justify it because they simply do not look at it.
They just look away.
Levy outlines a sophisticated, deeply entrenched architecture of media denial.
He makes a point to clarify that Israel has a totally free press, though. I mean, he is living proof of it. He publishes scathing critiques in a major newspaper and enjoys total freedom of speech from a legal standpoint.
The censorship is not coming from the government kicking down the doors of newsrooms.
Right.
It is censorship by consumer demand. Because the press is free, it relies on commercial ratings and advertising revenue.
The networks are privately owned, and their primary imperative is to keep viewers watching.
Just exactly. If an Israeli television network broadcasts the brutal, unvarnished reality of the military occupation in Gaza, the viewers experience immense cognitive dissonance and guilt, so they simply change the channel.
The networks know that showing reality hurts ratings, so they just stop showing it.
Levy makes a truly shocking comparison regarding the effectiveness of this self-censorship. He states that an average television viewer sitting in a living room in Omaha, Nebraska, sees significantly more actual footage of the destruction in Gaza than a citizen living an hour away in Tel Aviv.
Wow, an hour away.
The algorithmic feeds and international news priorities in the U.S. show the reality, while the domestic Israeli media deliberately shields its traumatized public to maintain its market share.
And to illustrate how deeply this denial permeates interpersonal interactions, Levy recounts a specific, devastating anecdote from a trip he took to a hospital in Hebron, located in the West Bank.
Right.
He was there interviewing the family of a 7-month-old baby who had just been killed by an Israeli soldier.
The details of the event are chilling in their banality. This happened during daylight hours, early evening.
Yeah.
A family was driving in their car. A father, a mother, 2 children, and an 80-year-old grandmother. According to the source, a soldier stopped the car, fired 2 bullets, and shot the 7-month-old baby in the head from a distance of 10 meters.
And the justification provided by the soldier was simply that he felt danger. He felt a lethal threat from a parked car containing an infant and an 80-year-old grandmother.
But Levy argues that the true tragedy isn't just the isolated action of the soldier. It is the systemic societal reaction to the event.
He asks the broadcaster point blank if he believes anyone in Israel was actually troubled by the story. Aside from Levy's own reporting, the mainstream media either completely ignored the death of the infant or framed it as a minor, unavoidable incident.
They reflexively justified the army's actions without investigation.
When Levy discussed the horror of the event with a friend, her immediate defensive response was, "Yeah, but he didn't intend to kill him."
We have to analyze the profound psychology driving that defensive reaction. Levy is explicit about this. Israelis are not inherent monsters.
Right.
He emphasizes that many view themselves as deeply liberal, emotional, and moral people.
But that self-perception is precisely why the denial must be absolute.
Exactly. If a liberal society actually forced itself to look at the daily, violent realities required to maintain a 59-year military occupation over millions of people, the moral weight would shatter them. They could not live with themselves.
It's like living next to a raging factory fire, but keeping the blinds tightly drawn and the TV volume cranked all the way up.
Yeah.
Because the moment you acknowledge the fire is real, the moment you look out the window and admit you see the flames, you are morally obligated to go grab a bucket and try to put it out.
And if you secretly know you are never going to grab a bucket, your only psychological survival mechanism is to violently insist the fire doesn't exist.
And to maintain that survival mechanism, the society constructs a closed psychological loop based on constant self-victimization. They perpetually cast themselves in the role of David fighting against Goliath.
Right.
They internalize the belief that the entire surrounding Arab world is constantly conspiring to push them into the sea, which allows them to categorize any aggressive action they take as justified, preemptive self-defense.
And that closed loop completely dictates how they view the rules of the global order. Levy points out their contradictory relationship with international law.
Oh, this was interesting.
Yeah, on paper, Israel is highly supportive of international law, recognizing that the modern framework was largely established in the aftermath of World War II and the horrors of the Holocaust.
Right.
However, Levy notes that Israelis inherently believe they're a special case. They believe international law is a wonderful concept for the rest of the world to follow, but due to their unique historical trauma, it cannot be applied to them.
And if the international community dares to apply those laws to Israeli actions, the closed loop provides an immediate defense mechanism. The accuser is instantly labeled as anti-Semitic.
If the world supports them, it proves they are righteous.
Right.
If the world condemns them, it proves the world is inherently prejudiced against them. Levy laments that the society never stops to ask internal questions like, did we actually do something wrong? Is bombarding Beirut a strategic error? The default conclusion is always, the world simply hates us.
That brings us from the societal architecture of denial to the specific political leadership exploiting the system. Naturally, a massive amount of international focus is centered on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Sure.
Levy details what he calls Netanyahu's life project, which has been forcing a direct military confrontation with Iran. Netanyahu operates on the belief that Iran represents an existential danger that can only be neutralized through warfare.
Aiming to dismantle their nuclear sites, destroy their ballistic capabilities, and ultimately force a regime change.
But Levy provides a damning assessment of that strategy, insisting that those grand objectives are functionally unachievable through brute force.
Yeah, he describes Netanyahu as standing before a strategic deadlock. Years of bombing campaigns and covert actions haven't caused the Iranian regime to disintegrate.
Right.
Arguably, the external pressure has only solidified their internal control. Yet, because Netanyahu only speaks the language of the sledgehammer, his only response to a failed military initiative is to apply even more force.
Because acknowledging that the Life Project has failed is politically impossible for him.
Right. But here is where Levy introduces a critical nuance that completely upends the standard narrative you often hear from Western observers.
Yeah, it is highly convenient, especially for the Zionist left and international liberals, to point the finger solely at Netanyahu.
Painting a picture where Israel was a beautiful, innocent, peace-seeking nation until this corrupt right-wing coalition hijacked the government.
And Levy completely shatters that comforting myth. He insists this is absolutely not just a Netanyahu problem.
We have to provide some historical context here for the listener.
Yeah.
The early days of the state were dominated by the labor movement, the kibbutz culture, the political factions that would eventually be recognized globally as the champions of the peace process.
Right.
But Levy looks at the raw data of the occupation and points out that Nobel Peace Prize winners, specifically icons like Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin, were actually responsible for initiating and building vastly more settlements in the occupied territories than Netanyahu ever did.
That is a staggering point. And Levy isn't just an armchair historian criticizing from afar. He actually worked as an aide for Shimon Peres for 4 years as a young man.
He saw the political machinery from the inside.
He argues that blaming the current right-wing government is a cop-out. The sickness, the reliance on military dominance over political compromise, was foundationally baked into the system's DNA from the very beginning.
This foundational critique brings us to the profound personal tragedy of Gideon Levy himself. He is not a foreign adversary throwing stones at a culture he doesn't understand. His roots are embedded deep within the founding trauma and the heroic mythology of the state.
During the broadcast, he shares the harrowing story of his parents, which perfectly encapsulates the foundational Zionist narrative. In 1939, his parents desperately fled the encroaching horrors of Europe.
Right.
His father ended up spending half a year at sea on an illegal, overcrowded boat packed with 600 desperate refugees, having no idea how they would secure food or water.
They were detained in Beirut before finally managing to reach Palestine.
The irony is that his father wasn't even an ideological Zionist. Levy notes his father barely knew the Jewish holidays.
The Land of Israel wasn't a political project for his family. It was quite literally their only physical rescue from the Holocaust.
His mother was similarly saved at the age of 16 through a project designed to rescue European children. They were violently uprooted from a comfortable life in Europe, and this new land provided their salvation.
But the contrast between his parents' desperate search for sanctuary and Levy's current reality as a dissident within that very sanctuary is incredibly jarring.
Because he refuses to participate in the societal amnesia, because he writes relentlessly about the realities of the occupation, he has been rendered an absolute outcast in his own home.
He mentions that he used to be a regular fixture on Israeli television panel shows. Now, he estimates he has been invited on air perhaps twice in the last 3 years.
The mainstream media has entirely blacklisted him because the commercial imperative to keep viewers comfortable leaves zero room for his alternative views.
And that isolation extends far beyond professional blacklisting. It bleeds into his daily physical reality.
The story about the park.
Yeah, he describes going for a jog in the park at 5:30 in the morning and having a woman recognize him and start screaming at him like a lunatic.
He notes that following the extreme polarization after the October 7th attacks, even some of his closest lifelong friends abandoned him. He admits to the broadcaster that he has never felt a loneliness quite as deep as what he experiences now. If the roots of this strategy go all the way back to the state's founders, and Levy admits he doesn't even have 7% of the population agreeing with him, what is his ultimate goal?
Right, why stay?
Is he just chronicling a collapse, or does he genuinely think staying and speaking out can change a deeply entrenched national trajectory?
He embodies the ultimate paradox of the patriot. When the broadcaster asks him if he has ever considered leaving, noting that he has a Swedish wife and could easily secure a comfortable, celebrated life in European academic or media circles, Levy's rejection of the idea is absolute.
He states firmly, "Sure, I'll stay." He intends to remain until his last breath.
He described a profound, unbreakable attachment to the physical land. It is the soil of his language, the geography of his childhood memories, the home of his remaining friends.
But it is an agonizing attachment. He confesses to feeling cheated by the comforting myths he was taught as a child about the absolute innocence of the state's creation.
He harbors deep shame regarding his country's current actions and an immense inherited guilt over the treatment of the Palestinian people from the Nakba onward.
Yet he explicitly refuses to leave because his parents' salvation from total annihilation is inextricably bound to the dirt of that nation.
He is trapped in a space where his moral outrage is constantly at war with his existential gratitude.
It is a stunningly complex emotional and political reality. So let's pull all of these threads together for you, the listener. We have covered a massive amount of ground today unpacking this dense source material.
We really have.
We started by exploring the visceral daily reality of endless, aimless wars and the psychological trap of the villa in the jungle mindset. A society that has convinced itself the only tool it can ever use is the sledgehammer of overwhelming military force.
We then analyzed the devastating consequences of that sledgehammer in Gaza, exploring Levy's terrifying assertion that the objective is the intentional, systematic destruction of civil society.
And how that strategy mirrors the historical blueprint and the societal amnesia of the 1948 Nakba.
Then we zoomed out to examine the geopolitical enabler of this entire system, the unconditional pipeline of U.S. military aid.
And by analyzing the specific sponsors of the broadcast, the testosterone clinics, the pro-life charities, the American-made gun safes, we saw how an America First audience is signaling a massive, potentially imminent shift away from that unconditional support.
We broke down the architecture of media denial, exploring the commercial mechanisms that allow a free press to deliberately shield a liberal society from the human cost of its own actions,
leading to the tragic normalization of violence, like the death of the infant in Hebron.
And finally, we looked at the deep systemic nature of the conflict, tracing the roots far beyond current leadership to the very founding of the state, and explored the lonely, unyielding patriotism of Gideon Levy himself.
As a final reminder, this deep dive was a strictly impartial exploration of the claims, historical analysis, and perspectives presented in the original broadcast transcript. Our goal was to provide you with a comprehensive understanding of the mechanisms and arguments detailed in the source material without endorsing or validating any specific political or moral viewpoints.
The conclusions you draw from this material are entirely your own.
But to give you one last thing to chew on as you process all of this, we want to leave you with a final lingering thought that builds on the geopolitical realities we've discussed.
Okay.
In a deeply globalized world, a smaller nation's internal identity, its military posture, and its ability to maintain massive cognitive dissonance are often entirely held together by the artificial gravity of a superpower's unconditional support.
Yeah.
But what happens to the social fabric, the politics, and the psychology of that nation the exact moment the superpower turns its attention inward and that artificial gravity is abruptly turned off?